Welcome to The Sit Down. I am Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is our latest addition to our Raging Chicken Radio podcast. On The Sit Down, we talk to activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble-rousers of all sorts to deepen our discussions and prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. If you are interested in contributing to Raging Chicken Press, or if you have an idea who you'd like to hear on The Sit Down, drop us an email at RagingChickenPress@gmail.com or send us a direct message on Twitter. We're at RC Press on Twitter. And if you like what we're doing here, you know, go over there and click on that support and membership tab and become a member for as little as $5 a month. The only way that we can keep doing what we're doing is through the support of progressives and activists like you. All right. So today on The Sit Down, we'll be talking with Dr. Amy Lynch Binyak. Amy is a faculty member in the English department at Kutztown University, my colleague, I have to say. Amy is interested in writing pedagogy, literacy studies, and labor studies. Her forthcoming book, Contingency, Exploitation, and Solidarity, Labor and Action in English Composition, is a co-edited anthology with Seth Kahn and Bill Lolliker that explores the ways and means of labor reform on college campuses. She is the chair of the State ABSCUF, that's their faculty union, State ABSCUF Adjunct Faculty Committee, and she is currently the editor of Forum, a peer-edited journal from the National Council of Teachers of English. Now, we've got Amy on the program today to talk a little bit about issues of adjunct and contingent labor in higher education, and this thing called the Indianapolis Resolution. We'll get into what that means in particular, but the resolution is urges professional organizations in the field of composition and rhetoric, the field that Amy is in, to actively cultivate equitable labor conditions in academic departments across the country. So welcome, Amy. How you doing?
I'm great, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so psyched that you're going to join us. You're joining us here on The Sit Down. And this is kind of an exciting time. We're kind of expanding out what we're doing here and all this. And, you know, one of the key issues that's near and dear to my heart, as you know, and we've worked together now for, God, what, 12 years or something like this? Yeah, it's something like that. I think so, you know, and one of the issues near and dear to my heart is kind of is, you know, labor organizing in higher education, particularly when we're talking about temporary faculty. That's the language that our contract uses. But really what we're talking about is adjunct faculty, contingent labor in higher ed. So before we get into kind of like the specifics of this Indianapolis resolution and what's going on here, right, give us a little bit of lay of the land of what's the conditions for adjunct labor look like in higher ed today?
Well, I think, first of all, what's fortunately getting more press, but it's still unknown by most of the public, is that the growing majority of faculty in higher education are some kind of non-tenure track or contingent faculty. So they're working as really short-time labor on shorter contracts. So right away, we find the majority of our professors are in precarious positions. You know, the moment you take tenure off the table, that you take a steady job off the table, that all by itself is affecting how effective a professor can be, whether or not he or she will feel comfortable exploring their teaching practices in innovative ways as opposed to playing it safe, whether they'll feel comfortable doing research that might be seen as out of the box or that challenges the authority. But even beyond that, this, you know, some estimates put it at like 75% of faculty nationwide are in one type or another of these contingent positions. Many of them are being paid abysmally, quite frankly. Certainly the conditions are different in each context from school to school, but generally speaking, contingent faculty are paid significantly less than their tenure track and tenured colleagues for doing much of the same work, if not carrying even heavier teaching loads at some times. While the some of our organizations, professional organizations, for example, suggest that a faculty member be paid, I think the number now is $7,350 per course. In some schools, that number can go as low as $1,200 per course. So what we're finding is faculty who, in order just to make ends meet, to pay their rent, to buy food, have to work at two or three institutions. I just had dinner last night with a young woman who is in several English departments. She's teaching seven classes across three institutions just to make rent, just to pay her student loans. So that is part of the terrain of what they're facing. In addition to that, they often don't have benefits. They don't have retirement packages. So it's precarious in lots of ways.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, here you have these concrete conditions, these material conditions of these contingent faculty members across the country. Just as you said, many are just, you know, living hand to mouth, basically trying to pay the rent, trying to pay the bills from week to week, often don't have health insurance. This is kind of something that just flies in the face of the, you know, the dominant perception of what a faculty member's life is like, right? So it's so kind of disjointed, you know, just kind of. On the one hand, you've got, you know, legislators across the country, like our state in Pennsylvania, certainly this in Pennsylvania, talking about faculty is lazy, that they only work a few hours a week, that they're the most privileged, they don't care about their students and all this. But meanwhile, like, you know, we're talking about, like, at the best estimates, we're talking about, you know, 25, maybe 28% of faculty are even tenured or tenured track, right? And then the percentage of those faculty that might qualify as that lazy faculty member is so minuscule that it just flies in the face of the reality. And yet you've got, you know, the bulk of the weight of higher education is falling increasingly on the weight of those faculty members.
And it's especially, speaking from my position in the English department, it's especially serious in English departments nationwide. We have some of the highest percentages of contingent faculty than any compared to other departments across the university. And that speaks to, you know, even how we treat kind of foundational courses for our students. More often than not, the foundational courses in writing and even in math and history and languages, the things that everybody has to take, are taught by these faculty who are driving around to three universities, who may not have office space, who may not have a parking spot, who may not even have a computer that's provided by the school in order to get their work done. And yet they're teaching these foundational courses. Like you said, this is not what students imagine when they step onto the college campus. It's not what the general public imagines our life to be. You know, there's the stereotype of the elbow patches and the pipe and the big office with the wooden desk and the books. But for many contingent faculty, the cliche, which is true, is that they're actually working out of their cars. You know, it's a far cry from that stereotype of the lazy professor.
No, it's incredible. And I remember back, you know, when I was in grad school in kind of the late 90s or so, that kind of labor issues were kind of front and center in the field of composition and rhetoric, precisely because, I mean, the same issues that you're talking about now. And here we are, like, almost 40 years later. And it seems like virtually nothing has changed, if not they've even gotten worse. And, you know, and it's one thing to study this stuff, right? It's one thing to actually, you know that these are issues in the field. And certainly I was aware of those as, in part because of all the work in the field as a graduate student. But then I remember when I got my first teaching job, right, was at George Washington University as an adjunct, right? I was getting paid $1,500 a class in Washington, D.C., which is an incredibly expensive place to live, $1,500 a class. I also worked at a bookstore. I worked for a nonprofit organization, and I would pick up odd jobs as we went along. And in my office, right? Yeah, we had an office, but it was an office that was probably 10 feet by 12 feet, maybe 13 feet, right? And there were nine of us that were supposed to share that office, right? So there's no way you're meeting with students in there, right? So it's like the reality of that hit so much. And it's like, you know, what do we do? So, I mean, has there been any progress? I mean, how would you characterize like the trajectory of what's going on in higher ed over the past like 30, 40 years?
You know, I think that the progress that has been made is on two fronts. I think on the first front, I, again, speaking for my particular discipline of English, one of the reasons I think English, and sadly, was on the forefront of this growing contingent workforce was because a lot of the work that we did in the English department wasn't considered really disciplinary. Basically, if you can write, you can teach writing. So a lot of the legions of people teaching writing were, it was easier to rationalize paying them less and treating them worse because they're kind of doing, you know, the broom pushing of the university. You didn't have to be a professional to do that. So in the English department, we've made a lot of progress in terms of arguing for the teaching of writing and rhetoric as a discipline and being recognized as professions. And I think there's been similar movement made in other departments in terms of earning respect for teaching freshman courses, seeing that as viable and useful work as well.
Right, but respect is quite different than being able to pay your bills, right?
Yes, yes. So while, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we didn't necessarily have a plethora of journals or conferences, now we do, which is great. The problem is the majority of people who are teaching CompRet can't afford to go to those journals and aren't necessarily, or go to those conferences and aren't necessarily supported well enough to write for those journals. So we've gotten you know, professional recognition, but that hasn't come with the kind of material recognition that allows us to do our jobs well. On the other hand, I do think that we've made progress in terms of organizing, sadly, only because the problem has gotten considerably worse. So, you know, in the past couple of years, I've seen articles in The Atlantic and The Washington Post and The New York Times about adjunct issues, which when I started as an adjunct, you know, 20 years ago, no one knew that word. When I told people I was an adjunct instructor, they had no clue what that meant. And now that word is getting visibility. So I think we've made progress in terms of bringing that fight to the public and helping them understand what's happening, for sure. And there's been a lot more organizing as a result.
Yeah, and I think that those are great examples. I mean, right now is that, you know, it's almost you can't go like a week without hearing about a new organizing drive, a new faculty union, whether it's not just adjuncts too as well, because I think increasingly you even see tenured and tenure track faculty feeling that their jobs are switching away. But really the front lines of this has been adjunct faculty who are organizing unions and are basically saying, you know, forget this. You know, I remember back in, you know, in the 90s, the big concern back then was like, well, you know, faculty members, you know, I don't know if we're a union, right? Because, you know, that's the dirty work that the blue collar workers do. And we're better than that. I think a lot of that has been erased by experience to the point where, you know, we have these organizing drives and people are winning and their conditions are getting better. So we're coming right up to a break. So let me, before, when we come back after the break, one of the things we're going to shift, we're talk a little bit about some of that organizing stuff a little bit later, but I want to get into some of the particulars of this Indianapolis resolution, because this is not the kind of stuff that generally makes the headlines in the Washington Post, in the Atlantic, in these kind of major publications, right? But it is nonetheless part of the nitty gritty work of organizing, right? The kind of stuff that happens inside professional organizations, that happens on college campuses and so on. And this is a really significant one, especially in the field of composition and rhetoric and the field of writing studies as a whole. So we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about that resolution, some of the background of that, and a little bit about kind of where we go from here. This is Kevin Mahoney. This is The Sit Down on Raging Chicken Radio. We'll be right back with Amy Lynch Beamer.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day that a shotgun blast broke through a closed window and struck Victor Reuther as he sat reading a newspaper in his living room. Victor, along with his brothers Walter and Roy, were leaders of the United Auto Workers Union, one of the most powerful forces of the 20th century U.S. labor movement. During the 1930s, the three brothers moved to Detroit and became involved in the hard-fought efforts to bring unions to the Motor City. Victor got a job at the Kesley Hayes Wheel Company. He joined UAW Local 174. During the Flint sit-down strike against General Motors, Victor gave speeches to help rally the strikers. According to Mike Smith of Wayne State University, Victor, quote, had this deep resonating voice. He coupled that with a superb control of the language. And when he got up to give a speech, it was usually a beauty. Victor would go on to become the UAW's education director and international director. Roy took up the role of legislative director. Walter became the union's president. Their union leadership made many enemies for the three Reuther brothers. Walter was the victim of a gunshot attack in 1948 that permanently injured one of his arms. The next year, an unknown would-be assassin took aim at Victor. The blast hit Victor in the face. He lost his right eye, and the bullet smashed his jaw and collarbone. In his memoir, Victor wrote that he told the surgeon, quote, "They can take out my eye and take of an arm or a leg, but please fix up my tongue. I've got a living to make." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I was standing by gate four when I heard the people roar. They ain't gonna kick the auto workers around. It's that UAW-CIO.
Welcome back to The Sit-Down. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit-Down is a new podcast as part of our project of Raging Chicken Radio. Today, we're sitting down with Amy Lynch Binyak, and we're talking about labor and higher education, adjunct labor, contingency, and specifically, we're going to shift now to a little thing called the Indianapolis Resolution. And one of the reasons I wanted to have Amy on to talk about this is, as I was saying before the break, is so much of what happens in the day-to-day organizing around labor issues is not the kind of sexy stuff that makes it into kind of national publications and so on. Right? A lot of organizing is local and takes place within specific, you know, environments, right? Particular rhetorical situations, as we would talk about in our field. But the Indianapolis Resolution just passed. Did it pass unanimously, Amy? Were there a couple people that said no at 4Cs?
At C's, well, the resolution itself didn't pass. What they asked us to do was to propose specific statements at the business meeting of C's that they then passed. And that's a distinction that the conference has asked us to make again and again. So it did. The core ideas did pass at the Conference on College Composition and Communication. It did. It was not unanimous. In fact, it was a little contentious, but there was an overwhelming majority in support, for sure.
No, I like that. You're insisted on, you keep on making those distinctions. This is the one thing that I find most troubling about working with academics, right? Is because they want to kind of break this stuff down. I mean, it's not just academics. I mean, but you know, this is our field. This is the kind of stuff where don't want to confront it right on. So they find these other ways to kind of parse things out or whatever. But that's another conversation for another day. So if we look at the Indianapolis Resolution, kind of what was kind of put forward there initially, I want to read kind of a couple of sentences from the introduction as a way of kind of giving folks that are listening to this a little bit of context. And then maybe then you can kind of fill us in about a little bit about what kind of got us to this point. What got you to the point where this was kind of on the floor of, you know, the main organization in the field of composition and rhetoric, the Conference on College Composition and Communication, right? Their national conference. So here's the Indianapolis Resolution as it kind of went forth. So this is from the executive summary. It says, the authors and co-signers of this document wish our professional organizations, institutions, and departments, programs in composition, rhetoric, writing, and English to work toward reducing the extent to which departments in the field writ large use and exploit contingency to solve problems that are primarily benefit the more secure members of those units. We endorse reforms that may better ensure institutional compliance with fair labor practices, that incorporate labor study into the graduate pedagogy and professional development, and that support research into the impact of labor practices on the teaching and learning of writing. So with that a little background, there's your kind of summary of it. What was the trajectory of this? What got us to this point where we had this resolution?
Honestly, I think where this all began, the kernel of it, is actually many years ago in 1987. Another group of activists and scholars and teachers at another conference got together to write something called the Wyoming Resolution, on which this is absolutely standing on the shoulders of the Wyoming Resolution, that called for many of the similar kinds of reforms that we do. But what we saw happen was that resolution, which called for the same things you just read, that wanted institutional compliance, a place where people could bring their grievances and you know, make public the abuses they were seeing in institutions and have someone publicly say, yes, what they're doing is wrong. What we saw happen was when it was adopted, even unanimously by some of our professional organizations, it was then defanged that anything that would actually hold a university or college accountable was taken out of it. So it became more of a policy statement saying, yes, be fair, treat people right. And those kinds of statements are useful. And we have many of them. Each of our professional organizations has some sort of excellent statement about the fair treatment of contingent faculty.
But right, but without the fangs, as you're saying, without the fangs, they could just be, okay, they're kind of feel-good statements to make people feel good about themselves, that they did this thing, but that they don't have to change anything about what they do.
Exactly. And they can be useful in that, you know, many people in the past 25 years have been able to take those policy statements to WPAs, to their chairs, to their administrators, and say, look, these are the kinds of problems that are being acknowledged publicly, and these are the recommendations that our professional organizations have. And so they've been helping people to make arguments, but only if the administration decides that they care. And very often they don't, right? So they've got limited use. And when a group of us gathered at a workshop at the 4Cs conference in 2014, we were talking about labor organizing and writing programs and writing centers, and we kept coming back to that point that we have support, we know what the problems are, and we were frustrated by the lack of action from our professional organizations, mm-hmm. that time and time again, their response has been, our position as a professional organization is to offer support or guidance or a place where we can come together and talk about ideas. It's not to sanction. It's not to have fangs, if you will. So the Indianapolis resolution was kind of our way of working through that and saying, okay, how can we create something that does have the power to publicly bring to light problems at individual institutions? That's important to you.
Absolutely. And I think about, you know, again, you know, the whole claim about as a professional organization where there's here to support and stuff like that, you know, it's a certain kind of abdication of responsibility, right? Because we have examples of other professional organizations that use teeth, right? Like medical professional organizations, legal professional organizations. You don't follow these things, you're disbarred, right? I mean, you're gone. So there's, yeah. I mean, there are, we have examples where there are teeth in other professional organizations. So I mean, it just highlights again, choices that people were making about how they understood what the role of this professional organization is. And it seems to me that at least in the language, when you're talking about the putting the fangs back in here, there's an attempt, you know, here to actually shift, not just, you know, not just make another statement, but actually shift to how we understand what a professional organization can do on these issues. Is that, would that be accurate for you to say?
Absolutely. You know, we don't want people to be, you know, forced into changing the constitutions of their organizations, although wouldn't it be great if some of them did. So what we did was say, okay, you can participate in something even greater, something collaborative. The Indianapolis resolution itself was just a product of an enormous collaboration. The people who contributed to its writing and revision and discussion were many, were legion, and ranged from graduate students to tenured professors. And you know, part of that inspired our idea to say, okay, if no one organization, the MLA, the RSA, the 4Cs, wants to take this responsibility, let's have all of these professional organizations, even more than those three, come together and contribute a member to a body that will do these things, that will hear grievances, that will mediate problems. And if those problems can't be mediated, then to make public the problems in individual institutions. So it is kind of a way of getting around that old argument of, no, we're hands off. We're just here for support, for sure.
Well, that's a really interesting move too, as well, because then by creating this, additional body, right, then they have, I mean, again, not 100% kind of, you know, objectivity or something, but they have a certain kind of semi-autonomy, right, to begin to understand their work as something that's separate from those organizations. So take us to a little bit. So, you know, if this goes through, if this starts moving in the direction that that you all have started, what are some of the teeth behind this resolution? What is the thing that would separate this out, or would actually not say separate it out from, but that would add in those things that people were frustrated about getting lost or left out from the Wyoming resolution?
Okay. We've got, you know, there are really three main parts to the resolution. The first is institutional compliance. The second is pedagogy. And the third is research. So the kind of actions we're hoping to come out of it is first this creation of a separate body. We're not giving it a name, and we haven't in the resolution tried to dictate rules for what this body would do. What we want is kind of a congress of people from throughout the profession, from different bodies coming together, who the individual faculty members who are experiencing labor problems on their campus could bring their appeals to this body, have their grievances heard, that the this centralized body could then suggest ways of solving the problems, could mediate with the administration, and if not, quite frankly, sanction in some way, to publicly say, University X is, in violation of the following best practices. And that speaks to something else that we're already making wonderful progress on, and that is just centralizing what those best practices are. I mentioned that many, many of our professional organizations have statements in support of faculty, but they're scattered. They're everywhere, online and offline. And so one of the things the resolution calls for is some sort of centralized place where all of this information can live. And what's wonderful is that Susan Doe over at the University of Colorado, who's already started doing this, Colorado State University has started the Center for Academic Study of Labor. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't made, with and for the Indianapolis resolution, but it's kind of a nice synergistic moment where they're kind of offering a space where we can do that kind of work. So that if you are a tenure track faculty member or you're a contingent faculty member or you're an administrator, you don't have to hunt and peck to find out what your rights are or, what's the recommended class size? What's the recommended course load? It's amazing to me just how little I knew about what was right and wrong when I began as an adjunct. I thought, my 6-course load was normal, only to find out, that, for instance, most of our organizations say, if you're teaching writing, you shouldn't have more than 60 students a semester. Not 6 classes of 25 or 30 students each in a single semester. So just being able to centralize that information so people know their rights. Because step one, you got to know your rights in order to know that you have something to grieve.
No, exactly. And I think this is one of the problems that we face over and over again as academics, is because I think most academics, when we're doing their training, right, you're training in a specific area of study. You're focused on the kind of intellectual work and so on. But there's a big gap, right? You're not given that kind of professional background, like as if that is something else that we shouldn't be studying. And that's one of the things that's also, called for in the resolution, is kind of, that research and to incorporate this stuff into that professional training. And so, that alone, because people start figuring it out, but they start figuring it out like 3, 4, 5 years into it, right? And by then, often you could be on a track that is going to kind of lock you into that kind of contingency for a long period of time. Now, personally, one of the things I really like about this resolution, this is the effect of growing up Catholic, right? The shame factor, right? I like the shame factor, I got to say, right? So like in here, you call about in here is kind of a seal of approval that would be used to issue departments and programs that fulfill the current disciplinary standards. Then to hear grievances from faculty who believe their departments and programs have violated those current standards, establish that process as you were talking about. But I love that idea of a seal. Right. Because then you've got the good actors, right, can throw that right up on the department web pages. Right. And then once you get to recognize what that is, you can see, okay, these people do this. And then, I start thinking about it, like, I want a bad actor seal too. I want the shame factor there too as well. Now, obviously no department is going to put that up on their own web page. Right. But that's a place where an organization like this, right, or a body like this, at least can make those determinations. And it gives people something to organize around. Right, that if this particular department is a notorious violator of labor rights and the and horrible conditions of adjuncts, well, then we could put pressure on it using this language as a way of moving forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you talked about not knowing and how we don't make this part of our education. It was really important to many of us who drafted the document that we talk about graduate education. And that labor conditions be part of it, not just because we want students to understand what they're getting themselves into and what the system is like, because there is that persistent myth that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. but even because it affects the teaching itself. As graduate students, we become enamored of this ideal teaching environment. We we dream of all the critical pedagogies that we're going to enact in our classrooms, how we're going to meet one-on-one with each of our students every other week, and so on and so forth. We're going to write tomes in response to each of their drafts. And then when you get out into the actual job market, into the real world, and you are employed as an adjunct and even as a tenure track faculty member, you realize, oh, I can't do any of that. My labor conditions don't allow me to. And I think it's important to train students not just for some ideal classroom, but also for the classroom they're more likely to be sitting in front of.
No, I think that's a great point. You know, it reminds me is one of my pet projects that I've been, so one of my dream little side projects along the way is to begin to accumulate clips, movie clips that represent faculty lives, right? By pictures of their offices, by pictures of their teaching conditions and those kind of stuff, and to run that counter to kind of what's actually out there. But we're coming up to another break here. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about, okay, so we've got this resolution, right? Then what does this mean actually kind of to moving forward for kind of like a tool for fighting, a tool for struggle, right? And why, you know, is this actually valuable, right? Is this whole idea valuable? I'm going to argue that it is, and I'm going to tell you a little bit of why. But then I want to ask Amy a little bit about, you know, okay, so now let's put ourselves, you know, this is a national organization. This is this resolution. Okay, so now you got people who go back to their campuses. They're on the ground here. And what's this mean for kind of where we kind of move forward? And I'll ask her to talk a little bit about that. All right. So we'll be right back. This is The Sit Down, the Raging Chicken Radio. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be right back after this. Hi, this is Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. In just 5 short years, we've helped bring unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. I started Raging Chicken in the wake of assaults on working people, women, and all things public following sweeping right-wing electoral victories in 2010. Since then, we've done our best to hold those in power accountable and refuse to pull punches. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. Our goal now is to make Raging Chicken Press sustainable. That means raising enough money to actually pay our contributors and grow our operations. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So I'm asking you to take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, you can help keep us going and support homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. For the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee once a month, you can make a huge difference. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member, leave a one-time donation, or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaires to fund our operations. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm sitting here with Amy Lynch Bienyk, and she's talking to us about adjunct labor and higher education contingency and what we can do about it. So right before the break, we're talking about the Indianapolis resolution. We're talking about this resolution as being a way for professional organizations to put some pressure upon departments to actually comply with equitable labor conditions and ways that this can actually aid faculty members who are interested in organizing around these issues to help organize and to put pressure back on those departments through their organization efforts. So, you know, as I was, we were talking about this, I started thinking a little bit about the Democratic primary right now. I know that's a huge jump there, but here, let me say, and I'm thinking about the debates that are going back and forth between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in particular, and whether or not, particularly coming out from the Sanders people, but whether it's worthwhile to try to change the Democratic Party. And I came across this article that was written by Seth Kahn, who is also, you know, you work very closely with Seth in terms of drafting the resolution and working with other people. I mean, Seth has been, you know, a friend of both of ours for quite some time, one of my kind of strongest comrades out there. And he was making a case, this kind of appeared in an article from the Majority Rule, the official blog of the new faculty majority, and a thing called The Case for Working in a among disciplinary organizations. And I just want to read this bit because I think it helps frame a little bit about why we would choose to do something like this. And he's responding to the question about whether it's worth doing this. And he says, quote, "I firmly believe that our professional organizations can be powerful forces for normalizing the discourses of labor equity. The policies we put in place may have no legal force. The resources we can offer probably won't overwhelm the resources of neoliberal hegemony. But healthier organizational discourses keep us from sounding like the troublemakers and instead makes people who don't speak those discourses sound as inhumane as they are." And I couldn't help but think about the discourse in the presidential campaign. And here's the connection with the Bernie Sanders campaign. It's like to think that, I mean, in my lifetime, you know, we grew up like Cold War babies and all those other kinds of stuff, right? To think that you'd have a presidential candidate who was a contender for the nomination to be openly talking about being a socialist was unthinkable, right? Yeah. The fact that, you know, he talked about socialism, he talked about taxing the rich, making Wall Street pay, like economic inequality. I mean, these are the kinds of things that I think Seth is kind of making reference to, is that by normalizing that discourse, right, you know, people who are doing that organizing aren't sounding like, oh, you're the one who are trying to destroy the world, but you're the ones who are actually, you know, behind what is good and what is right. And it's those people, the administrators, the management, this whole kind of neoliberal approach to higher education that is the problem. So, you know, in that spirit, I was thinking about, you know, pushing from within these organizations and then actually trying to kind of move that ball forward. When we start taking a resolution like this and then kind of going back to our campuses and so on and thinking about, how this might aid in people that are actually doing the organizing, whether it's, you know, at Kutztown University's campus or kind of any campus across the country. I mean, how might you see those connections? What might somebody do with this?
That's a really good question. And I think it works on a lot of different levels. And that's important because everybody has different comfort levels when it comes to activism as well. You know, I've spoken to some non-tenure track faculty, for instance, who are rightfully very wary of being in the spotlight, and I respect that. I've always been one to yell at the top of my lungs, but that doesn't mean I think everybody should. So I think there's lots of ways to enact this. And, you know, for instance, a very, very simple one goes back to, you know, how we talk to our students about labor issues, whether they be undergraduates or graduate students, as we mentioned before, that if we make the connections between labor conditions and learning conditions part of our everyday conversation about their education, right? I think that goes a long way to normalizing, as you were saying, this discourse that we aren't crazy, they're not going to just see that conversation as something external to their lived experience, but it's something there all the time. And that's something that all of us can do to one degree or another. But, you know, the other, I think that the resolution gives us a tool to speak to administrators very powerfully. We live in an age where universities are becoming so corporatized that they are very concerned with image, right? They're very concerned with PR. And whether it's the seal of approval and saying, going to your administrator and say, hey, I'd like to work on getting this seal of approval from this body. Or going to your administrator and saying, you know, we're in violation of these principles and we are ripe to have someone bring a grievance to this body. That can be a powerful motivator towards action on the ground, to, you know, to have that conversation, whether it be with your chair or your dean or your provost. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think about it like this too, as well. I mean, I'm an unapologetic kind of union guy who believes that, you know, that unions really, that kind of organization could be one of the greatest tools in this fight. Right. And I think that, you know, the idea, you know, I think about, on the one hand, we've got this discourse, we've got this resolution. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that, and you're far more diplomatic person than I am, and you know this, that, you know, those kind of conversations become important. It's that kind of, like, say, diplomatic move, say, look, this is kind of important. This is something that that could actually benefit us if we have this seal. But at the other end of it too, as well, it can be the tool where, you know, to organize around, like, these are the conditions, this is why we are organizing organizing a union. This is why we are organizing to fight back for our rights. This is why we believe that this university is in violation of some basic kind of labor conditions. So I think about that as, you know, I already have these images in my mind. If you have to, I'm waiting to see what the seal looks like so you can put on a picket sign and then cross it out as you're picketing outside in front of your in front of your university.
Yeah. You know, and even we talk about organizing, and I'm reminded again and again how many of us across the university often still feel isolated and feel they're not necessarily sure if what's happening in their program or their department or their campus is normal or not. There's a great article coming out, if you don't mind me plugging this, in Forum, issues about part-time and contingent faculty in the fall, where a group of faculty are doing a study of Writing Center directors and staff, most of whom today are contingent as well. And one of the things they found in interviewing hundreds of Writing Center staff members was that most of them had no clue if the conditions on their campus were normal. You know, and so the resolution and the bodies it's proposing allows people to feel connected, allows people to feel a sense of where they stand in relation to the field writ large, you know, locally and nationally. I think that the new faculty majority does a great job of this as well. And if any of your listeners or viewers are interested in learning more about these issues, that's a great place to start, is the new faculty majority. But I think that we can do some basic organizing work here and just letting people know how their conditions measure up to conditions across the country.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I'm reminded of, you know, the first interviews I ever did for Raging Chicken Press was with Noam Chomsky. And one of the things that Noam Chomsky talked about was how that, you know, some of the biggest social movements start with something as simple as getting a stoplight at an intersection that's dangerous, right? The idea of building that that notion that you can win, right? If you organize, you can win. And I see this kind of a step kind of in that direction. So, Amy, if there's people that are interested in this resolution and they're interested in kind of showing their support, is there a place that they can go to kind of either sign on to this or kind of support?
Absolutely. The easiest place to learn more about and even sign the Indianapolis Resolution, if you'd like, is to go to compositionist.net. That's composition with an IST on the end, .net. And you'll find a button there that says Indianapolis Resolution. There is some background information there that discusses the day we all came together to first start drafting this. You can read the resolution in full. And you can actually digitally sign if you like, which we very much appreciate. You can also feel free to contact me if you're interested in taking this resolution to your professional organization or you know, even to your campuses and talking about it more. And I'd be glad to talk more about it to anyone.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure we get links both to Amy's email and to the Indianapolis Resolution that'll go in the show notes down here to make sure that people got it. And I just want to remind everybody that we're fortunate enough to be joined today by Dr. Amy Lynch Beniak, who's a faculty member in the English Department at Kutztown University. I want to plug again, Amy, do we have a publication date yet for that book?
I believe it's going to come out in January of 2017.
Around January. Well, look for it. She is the, her forthcoming book is called Contingency, Exploitation, and Solidarity, Labor and Action in English Composition, and it's co-edited with Seth Kahn and Bill Lolliker. Please check it out. I know Amy's work well, and I mean, seriously, is one of the strongest voices in support of equitable labor relations in higher education right now. So, you can let your head swell on that for a little bit. How's that? But it's absolutely true. Don't take my word for it. Just go read her stuff. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Amy.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. This is Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. And this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back. And don't forget, on next Tuesday, we'll have our regular scheduled podcast, that Out the Coop, where we'll be sitting down with Sean Kitchen. And you can look for continuous interviews coming up as part of The Sit Down at Raging Chicken Radio. You can check us out on the Podbean. That's the best place to go. Get the Podbean app or check us out online looking for Raging Chicken Radio. But we are also on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play Music. We're all over the place. So if you're looking for us, just put Raging Chicken Radio in there and you're sure going to find us. And don't forget to like us, to, you know, to subscribe to us and to leave us a comment. Let us know that you're checking us out. This is Kevin Mahoney signing off. Until next time, everybody.
See ya.